On this episode of Skeptico, investigative reporter and author of The Gift and Best Evidence, Michael Schmicker.
When you mentioned that comment that 100 years of nothing, from my own research, is that really what we've had is 100 years of ignorance and 100 years of intellectual dishonesty.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and today we have a great, delightful interview for me with Michael Schmicker, author of a couple of books that I'm going to tell you about as we get into the interview. It's pretty long. I'm going to jump right into it. Here goes. We're joined today by the author of a couple of very interesting books that we're going to talk about. The first, Best Evidence, an investigative reporter's three-year quest to uncover the best scientific evidence for ESP, psychokinesis, mental healing, ghosts, poltergeists, dowsing, mediums, near-death experience, reincarnations, and other impossible phenomena that refuse to disappear. Whew, quite a long title, but one that really tells what the book's about. The other book we're going to talk about is The Gift, ESP, The Extraordinary Experiences of Ordinary People, a book he co-authored with Dr. Sally Ryan Feather, who is the daughter of J.B. Ryan, the founder of the famous Ryan Research Center at Duke. So with all that as way of an introduction, Mike Schmicker, welcome to Skeptico.
Great. Thanks so much, Alex. Appreciate it. I think it's good. It's important that people hear about these things and think about them anyway.
Well, great. I was really glad that you, one, agreed to the interview, and then, two, that you directed me to your second book, The Gift, about ESP, because it really fits into the topic I wanted to talk about. And also in the email that you sent me, I saw that you acknowledged that I had just spoken with Mike Timm about his book on the spiritualist movement of the turn of the century. And I just think the work that you've done fits in really nicely as a bookend to that, to kind of, the general theme is to dispel this idea that I think I had in my head and a lot of folks had in their head, because it just gets repeated over and over again as this kind of skeptical mantra that there's 100 years of nothing that parapsychology has produced. And I guess I have to admit that I, to a certain extent, bought into that even a little bit myself. And through your books and through Mike Timm's book and also through a very great book called Extraordinary Knowing, I think I've educated myself a little bit. And that was really the basis of what I hope will become the basis of our conversation today.
Yeah, Alex, you know, I think I appreciate when you mentioned that comment that 100 years of nothing. I often laugh at Mike Timm, and I think that we would Mike can speak for himself, but from my own research, and I think I can back this up doing this interview, is that really what we've had is 100 years of ignorance and 100 years of intellectual dishonesty. I think I'd explain it this way. In terms of ignorance, sometimes it's understandable ignorance. Somebody doesn't have the time, the interest to follow something up, so it's not deliberate. Other times it's deliberate in the sense that I'm constantly, when people find out, I have a real job, actually. This writing is really my hobby on the side.
Quite an interesting one from doing a little Googling of you. I mean, what an interesting job you have, but that's probably another show.
Right. But the net of it is that I think I'm stunned constantly by skeptics and scientists and people who, when they hear that I've done some research in this area, say, well, what you just said, the 100 years of nothing. And my answer back to them always, and I think it's a fair question, is, what have you read? Because I wouldn't go into the astronomy field and ask somebody or make pronouncements about black stars or quasars or the Big Bang or anything like that without having read the literature. And I'm absolutely stunned at the ignorance of most skeptics and scientists in this field. And sometimes it's sort of a deliberate, proud stupidity.
You know, Mike, I am really glad that you put it that plainly and that bluntly, because I have to say, and I'm all for a dialogue with open-minded skeptics and people in mainstream science who don't have the same view that I do. But really, I really don't like when we soft pedal the state of affairs, you know, and I think you use two words that are really good there. I mean, stunned is really no other way to really describe the situation that's going on. And I think also that prideful stupidity is also another good comment. And I would just add to that, you know, two of the folks that have been on this show, Michael Shermer, James Alcock, two of the people that are regarded very highly within the skeptical community, have made just that claim on this show. So just to bring it down to specifics, so folks don't think we're talking in abstract terms about people saying this 100 years of nothing thing. I mean, this is a repeated, like I say, it's a mantra of the skeptical community and the mainstream science who likes to kind of play that game too. And what I think we can do here, and I hope we can do, is maybe show how some of the work that you've done in bringing some of this research that's really been out there, been done by all the right people, was very, very highly regarded at the time, has really never been refuted and is just, as you say, fallen into kind of the little crevices of science history. But for a scholar, for someone who has some kind of scholarly credentials, they should be knowledgeable of this stuff. And I can plead being a little bit ignorant of it, but when I look to the folks who are supposed to know, I can't really explain why they don't know.
I think, again, what I tell people is, look, I didn't start out in parapsychology. I was a journalist by background. I've done mostly business journalism. I did some investigative journalism and some journalism when I was in during the Vietnam War in Asia. And my point is that when I set out to look at this material, as the subtitle of book Best Evidence says, I spent 3 years. It wasn't complete full-time. Obviously, I had other jobs to do. But I read hundreds and hundreds of books and monographs and studies and looked at both sides on things. And somebody would say something and somebody else would say something else. I read the PsyCops magazine. I read the Skeptical Inquirer. I read all the Journal of Parapsychology articles and that. And I guess my point, my frustration, and I'm getting a little crankier as I've spent more time in the field. My feeling is, if you want to talk with me, I don't mind if you come to me and you say, where's the evidence? That's a fair question. But if somebody from the scientific field or a skeptic comes to me and says, there's 100 years of nothing, my answer is pretty scientific. What's your basis for saying that? Have you read anything? Do you know who Charles Honnerton is? Have you ever heard of Stargate? Have you ever heard of the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Laboratory? Do you know anything about Ian Stevenson of the University of Virginia, Chester Carlson? Do you know anything about J.B. Ryan? If you look through Best Evidence, behind that 286 pages or whatever it is 3 years of hundreds and hundreds of stuff. And my only request, and now it's a demand, to people who want to talk with me is, I don't mind if you want to talk in general in that, but I don't want to be insulted. So if you want to talk serious about this thing, I want to know how much you've read first. Because it's like if I tried to talk to an astrophysicist about black holes, in about 2 minutes, he's going to say, I'm wasting my time. You don't even know the basics.
Right. Right, right. That's well said. That's a good point.
So, I mean, that's what I mean by 100 years of ignorance. Please don't tell me these things unless you've read the literature. And I just stop at that point. I say, if you haven't read it, I appreciate you. I'm glad you're talking. And I appreciate what you're talking. But I'm really not interested in a long conversation because, frankly, you don't know the literature any more than I know the literature of astrophysics.
Well said. And you know what I thought we might do in the little bit of time that we have is really compress it down. And I want to look at a relatively brief period in history. I want to look at the end of the William James era, and then I want to look at the beginning of the J.B. Ryan era, if you will, and era's the wrong word there, but their work.
Okay.
And the reason I want to do so is because just like when I spoke with Mike Timm on the last episode, I have to admit that what was in the back of my mind as someone who, like you, has come to the parapsychology field not with any kind of preconceived notions and without a deep scientific background, mm-hmm. but I just had this idea in the back of my head that, yeah, there were these spiritualists at the turn of the century, and they were kind of all fakes, and Houdini kind of debunked it all, and there was nothing real there. And then that was just ignorance on my part, and I knew that there was probably a mix of some real and some not, but it's only when someone really deconstructs the whole thing that you kind of see what a different picture really emerges from that. So here's where I thought we might pick it up. Let's start with William James. And what I think I didn't know and what a lot of folks didn't know is they think of William James and they know that he had some influential writings on the intersection of science and spirituality. But I think what a lot of people don't know is what a leading kind of huge figure he was of his time and still is in, you know, a main pillar in the field of psychology. So can we start with maybe at the very end of his life and when he's kind of brought together a tremendous amount of interest in parapsychology and what the stage was like at that point?
First of all, I think that James was interested because he had an open mind. And one of the things, and we're collapsing a lot of, again, we're collapsing hundreds of articles in a couple of sentences here. But one of the things that James, about parapsychology and the quote-unquote paranormal was, he found a medium that he called his white crow. And I think Mike Timm probably mentioned that. And her name was Leonora Piper. And what it meant was that he said that the easiest way to prove that all crows are not black is to find one white crow. And that's the same thing. The easiest way to prove that the paranormal exists is to find one paranormal phenomena that exists. From that point on, you're talking about how many there are, not whether it exists. And I think that he and the giants of that period realized that science had gotten itself into a box, a bad dead-end box. And the box was that in the 17th and 18th centuries, and right into the 19th century, the battle was between a natural explanation and a supernatural explanation. And both of those are fundamentally philosophies. A supernatural explanation is a religious or a philosophical position. A natural explanation depends on how you define reality. Reality meaning what is the world made of, what is real. And unfortunately, at the time of James, science took a detour. Instead of sticking with evidence, the scientific method, there was the brilliance of science is, show me the evidence. They took a philosophical point of view, and that philosophical point of view is materialism, which is a philosophy. It's not science, it's a philosophy. It's a philosophy that believes that everything in the world is made of matter of a certain kind. And at that point, it became in stone, and what James was trying to do was trying to say, look, maybe reality is larger than materialism as a philosophy. And I think that was his genius, and that's what we're coming back around to in the 21st century, particularly with reality being redefined by quantum physics and other things. So one thing was that he tried to bridge a gap. He tried to get science out of a dead end unsuccessfully. When we go on to J.B. Rhine's era, Rhine accepted the dead end science definition of materialism and the current and the philosophy of science at that time. And so he accepted, we'll use the tools of science as defined, laboratory experiments, when in fact reality is much broader than a laboratory experiment and sometimes doesn't operate under a laboratory conditions. But he was smart enough to say, look, if we're going to get any ground with the reigning scientific philosophy of our era, we have to accept their rules. And that's what he did. He brought it into the laboratory, and he, using their own rules and philosophy called scientism, the philosophy of materialism, he did show, I believe, that ESP, for instance, the forms of ESP are real under the rules of the philosophy of materialism, which is what science had. So I think that was his great contribution to parapsychology. Unfortunately, it worked for a while. It was very good, but it was a dead end also. Parapsychology is a dead end. We need to get out of that and get into the fact that we're not talking about paranormal. We're
right.
talking about normal.
Yeah, and you know what? I think I'm totally with you on that. But I'm going to bring you back here for a minute. And I want to narrow our focus
sure,
a little bit on a couple of things in particular, which you're just talking about with J.B. Ryan. Because one of the things I've found on Skeptico in my dialogue with skeptics, which for the most part has been great and has been a real give and take. And the one thing I hear from skeptics is, show me the evidence. And a lot of times, like we just ranted about maybe at the beginning, they might not be as aware of the evidence, and they haven't done their work on the side of that equation of show me the evidence. But I want to honor that show me the evidence, and I want to go back and narrow the focus on some of J.B. Ryan's work. And just to, you know, the part I'd add that I found interesting about the William James biography is, you know, he's really got things going in his direction at the time that he's passing. I mean, he writes The Principles of Psychology in 1890, and that is it. I mean, everyone is at his feet. He is the guy, and he gets the American Society for Physical Research, and he has absolutely the cream of the crop of intellectuals at the time, and he's getting the standing ovations, and everyone's listening to him, and there are the dissenters. But then, as so often happens, when he dies, it kind of, the mantle, you know, gets passed, and it gets passed to Freud, and then it gets passed to B.F. Skinner, who is, you know, a behavioralist and is also at Harvard.
Right.
And now, you know, the world has changed again, and everyone kind of rocks back into that comfort of materialism that you just talked about. What I thought was interesting about Ryan when I read up on him was that he starts out as a debunker. I mean, he starts out as a skeptic in his first contribution, real contribution that gets McDougall even gets his attention, is that he finds this very famous medium in Boston, Marjorie, and goes for a seance and sits down and says, you know, I don't think she's real. And I think if you apply careful scientific standards to evaluating her, she doesn't pass the test.
Ryan originally believed in, Ryan was wrestling obviously with the life after death question. And that's the 800 pound gorilla in the room.
Absolutely right.
Battling with. That's the heart of all of the debate that we're talking about is there life after death? Because that was what religion and science battle about from the beginning, and who would control the belief on that side. But I think Ryan originally had heard Arthur Conan Doyle speak, and he liked it, and he went to the Marjorie Crandon seance, realized that, you know, there's too many ways to have fraud here. So the best way to do it is bring it to a laboratory. And I think that in terms of laboratory experiments, a couple stand out from an evidence point of view. And they're described in Ryan's books. So anybody who's looking for the evidence can look at the data in the background of that. The Pierce-Pratt series of ESP tests, very famous.
Right.
Series of ESP tests.
Mike, will you take a few minutes and really take us through those? Because I think it's fascinating stuff. And again, back to our point of, you want evidence, let's just take one little piece there, because it's pretty compelling work, I think.
Again, I don't have all the details in front of me, so this is what I remember. It's obviously described in Best Evidence and in lots of books. So anybody who really wants, of your listeners who really want to know more about it, they can find plenty about it. But basically, there were two individuals. He was trying to find out whether telepathy existed, or ESP, in any of its forms. And he had two individuals at the Duke University campus, and he separated them in two different buildings. And he had them do card tests, and somebody would flip over a card in one room, and the other person in a room, you know, 100 yards away or 300 yards away, would write down what he thought that card was every minute. So if card turns over, one room, another room, 100 yards away on the campus, person knows that every minute he's going to make a judgment. And he puts down, oh, I think it's the Ace of Spades, or I sense it's the Ace of Spades, or whatever. And they go through the thing, and then he used statistics, which everybody accepts nowadays. I used statistics to see if chance was the explanation for that success. And the man in the Pierce Pratt series did have tremendous success. A lot of, let's say, and I'm just remembering here, Alex.
I actually have the figures right in front of me, Mike. Okay. Yeah, I mean, the success was unbelievable. And they did almost 2,000 trials, and he scored above chance 20 billion to one.
Yeah.
And at one point, I was just going to say, and at one point, he got 25 in a row correct,
exactly.
Which is something like a trillion to one against chance, or just some unbelievable number.
Now, one of the things that happens on that is from the point of view of evidence is that if you accept the rules of the game that science put out, material science put out, and Ryan did, you have to do many, many tests. If one person, it could just simply be an anomaly that'll never happen again. Theoretically, only those two people had ESP in the world. In other words, science requires repeatability in laboratory experiments.
Sure.
And what Ryan did was continue to do this for over, I don't know, several decades. And his goal was to build up enough evidence that under the rules that science requires, that you could show that chance was not the explanation. And I think that clearly by the 1940s, between the Pierce Pratt experiments and all the books that he wrote and all the materials he had, at each time a skeptic come back and say, well, you know, there may be sensory leakage here. You know, maybe he cued him, or maybe he heard something, or maybe he saw something, or, you know, maybe he peeked over his shoulder, or maybe the cards were not random, or maybe you can do a million questions on the design of the experiment. And what Ryan did to his credit, over 20 or 30 years was to continually refine and tighten the protocols, the scientific rules for how he conducts the experiments. And in the end, he did establish, I believe, and I think most honest viewers of the evidence would conclude, that there is scientific proof based on statistics that ESP exists in its various forms under those rules. And I think that was his gift to the scientific anomalies research, that he used their rules under their game. And the next set of tests, which was even more important, and you probably got in front of you there, is the Charles Honorton test. Want me to go over those?
Yeah, please, let's go over those. And the only thing I was going to add about the Pierce Pratt experiments and all the skeptical criticism that came and the tightening of the protocols, I've experienced some of that in the little experiment that we've gotten into with the medium work that we've done. And I just think so much of the criticism is just complete nonsense. And I think that we've done this other side, the parapsychology, the psi side, hasn't done as good a job as they can in doing the PR work to say, if you believe these other things exist, then show how they exist. And I think show how that sensory leakage could happen conceivably in that way. Because what I see from the skeptics a lot of times when you talk about, and I've never been a big fan of originally, and that's, I guess, my motivation for this show, is I always saw the J.B. Ryan work because he did take normal people. He wasn't looking for the kind of white crow, which I find kind of more compelling. And because it had taken the soul out of it. You know, you and I just mentioned a minute ago, or you mentioned, and I agree with you, that continuation of consciousness is really the issue, you know, and all these other issues are kind of sideshows. So I was always, I think, rather dismissive of this research. And that's why I wanted to bring it on the forefront, because when I dug into it, I saw something different. I saw a guy who had come out of a long exposure and a lot of frustration with the spiritualism and the consciousness continuation, said, no, let's take it down and let's make it really airtight laboratory. And what I see is when he did, he got darn good results. He got great results. And he just was fighting against such a tide of criticism. And I just don't see how any of the wide majority, the vast majority of the criticism was really unwarranted and just wasn't done in the way that scientific criticism is normally done, where someone says, gee, you know, that's great. I think, let's see if it really works. Let's roll up our sleeves and work together and see if we can do it. What I saw was a lot of debunking, which is so typical of the materialistic, skeptical kind of side that says, hey, let me find anything that I can throw at this to cast some doubt on it so I can be dismissive of it.
Well, I think that's a great point, Alex. I think the problem or what Ryan could have said to his critics were, You know, it's not enough to say theoretically something can happen.
Exactly, right.
You know, as if someone says, well, you know, X may have happened. Well, it's up to you to show, for instance, any piece of research that's done today, and we do research for the Office of Naval Research and such so on that, and we have data that we do. We design hulls for the U.S. Navy. And someone, if we ever applied this theoretical nonsense that people applied to Rhein, some of it was not all. Some of it was very good, because there was some sensory leakage, I think, at some points, and there were some ways where it was at least certainly possible that could happen. But you get to the ridiculousness of, you know, well, maybe the person lied.
Right.
Or maybe they snuck around the middle of the night and they dropped in something in the room and then there was a peephole that did so-and-so. And if that was ever applied to most modern research, it would grind to a halt.
Exactly.
I mean, you have to have some, if you believe something was done trickery, it's not enough just enough to show that trickery could happen, because I can put that to any medical research that you produce today.
Exactly.
If someone says diabetes is caused by whatever, sugar, I can say, well, you know, how many times did you test the sugar? Maybe the sugar is made of so-and-so. Maybe the people changed the data. Maybe they lied.
Yeah.
Maybe that guy had a friend that did so-and-so. Anyways, you get to the point where you say, well, please stop. You know, if you've got some evidence, bring it out. But let's not be ridiculous. And I think that that's, you know, the worst of Ryan's critics were that way. The best were good. They said, you know, tighten it up, and he helped him. But to finish on up for ESP in terms of evidence, the next major, in my mind, and in best evidence, that's the way I presented it, the next major step was the Charles Honorton Ray Hyman series of tests. And Ray Hyman was a leading skeptic, is a leading skeptic, fairly honest, member of PSYCOP, the skeptic, the debunkers operation, but relatively open. And he and Charles Honorton created an airtight series of protocols to test ESP. And Hyman said, if you do your ESP tests under these rules and you get positive results, then you've got something. And that's exactly what happened. They're called the Hyman-Honorton tests. And anybody, if you look them up on the web or on any, you know, parapsychology groups or even in science or so on that, you'll find those tests. And those tests were conducted by the leading skeptic saying, I'm going to tell you how to test. And then the answer to Charles Honorton back was, if I do it this way, and this is as tight as you can make it, and I get those results, will you say they're real? He said, yes. In the end, he had to admit, yes, chance can't explain what happened. So those tests were extremely important in terms of evidence. They built on Ryan's research because the protocols were so exceptionally good.
Right. And I think that, you know, there's two things about that. Because one of the things I always hear skeptics say is, yes, but as we tighten the protocol, the effect size got smaller and smaller, and that therefore there's some kind of trend to it not being any real effect, but some kind of statistical anomaly. And I think that, to me, is just another version of the same story of, well, then you have to prove that. And I think also, you know, Dean Radin in his book summarizes that research quite nicely and does some new statistical analysis.
Oh, yeah, he's excellent. His books are excellent.
And shows that, you know, when you have the millions and millions of trials that you do at this point, if you take anyone's data, you still have a hugely significant result. But I think that that also waters down the effect of some of this earlier research that we really can't dismiss out of hand just because there was this supposed claim that could be made that there could potentially be some sensory leakage. So I think the data is actually really probably even much better than it is normally reported, because I think we keep taking this fallback position and accepting all the skeptical challenges. Say, okay, we'll throw this out, and we wind up with, you know, still a very solid case, but then they're like, oh, yeah, but look, your effect size is going down further and further as you go. So
I think one of the problems is that at a certain point, I don't think you're going to convince people, Alex. I don't think you're going to convince a scientist who won't believe.
Right.
I just think that you could, no matter what you did in terms of your testing, you will never, ever convince diehard skeptics, debunkers, I would call them, of the reality. It's just you have to wait till they die off. I don't believe that there's, that's one of the things I've talked to Dr. Ryan's daughter about. You know, at one point she still believed that you could continue to do these tests and so on, and ultimately at some point they would be accepted. And I don't think it's a question of evidence. I think it's a question of belief. I think that the established science and skeptics specifically will not accept it no matter what you offer them, period. And that was why I think that the movement has moved away from Rhine's tests and Honorton's tests and stuff like that. And we've really got to the point where they're just going to sidestep the whole thing. But people are moving into consciousness research, which is a huge area that's going to be the next big field in this area, next big area of study. And people are just simply saying, you know, sorry, see you later. We're going to move on. And I've argued with Sally about that a lot. My feeling is it's a waste of time to talk any more to anyone who has objections to the data. I just don't think it's worth a discussion. If what we've got so far can't convince you that there's something anomalous there, then I'm sorry, there's just no more time for any debate. I don't want to voice...
You know, I completely understand your point, Mike. I take a slightly different tact, and that's that I agree with you, the entrenched, close-minded skeptics are not going to wake up tomorrow and see the light any more than fundamentalist religious people, be they Christian or Islamic or whatever, are going to turn back on their doctrine. And we just had an interesting show with Christian Science writer about that and kind of reached that same point. That's human nature. The part I guess I see slightly differently is I think we need to hold science, if you will, if we can say that, accountable. Science is a method. It's not a position. And this position of materialism that has kind of become to dominate and is totally closed to looking at the evidence, I think we really need to put those people on the spot. And I think the only way to do that is with new research that keeps pushing the boundaries and keeps hammering at these taboo topics and really puts them right out in their face. And in that respect, I think, you know, ESP research, although it's not the most compelling to me and it doesn't really get my motor going, hey, I'm all for that as long as you realize that what you're really doing is trying to put it in the face of all the people who in the scientific community refuse to even accept the methods of science and are corrupting the process by not doing that.
Yeah, I'm not saying I think it's worthwhile. It's just that I think that if you've ever been cornered by a Mooney,
right?
Reverend Moon in the 80s, I had these people run around different. They were at the university, I was there at one point, and no matter what you say, they're really going to try and get it back to their belief. My feeling is that you could spend days and nights, and they'd corner you in a cafeteria and try and talk to you for hours and stuff like that, and you really realize that they weren't really interested in a dialogue.
Right, right.
They were really interested in converting you. And my feeling is that, you know, I think we've got that. I'm very optimistic. I think history, I'm very happy to let history decide who's right.
Right, right.
I'm very, very confident that history is going to show that all of the phenomena that, for instance, that I mentioned in Best Evidence, are real. They may be quirky, they may be unpredictable, they may not be controllable the way physical objects are, but they're all real, and that eventually we will accept them as real. But can I mention two things, Alex?
Certainly, yes.
Yeah, one of the things, let's go for the point of intellectual dishonesty, because that besides that 100 years of ignorance, I think there's 100 years of intellectual dishonesty, and let me explain it. I think there's intellectual dishonesty by established science and there's intellectual dishonesty by individual science skeptics. And let's take them one by one. By established scientists, I think there's three points that I would make. One is it's intellectually dishonest to only take part of the evidence. And the part that they take is the laboratory experiment. I think that's intellectually dishonest to say that the only things that are real can be proved in a laboratory. The second thing is, I think it's intellectually dishonest to say that these are extraordinary claims. I don't think that a claim of a poltergeist is any more extraordinary than a claim for meteors. In other words, both of them should rest on evidence, and both of them, I don't think you need extraordinary proof to for ESP or for poltergeist. You just need good proof that these things are not extraordinary. Who decides that a poltergeist phenomenon is extraordinary?
Oh, exactly.
Claim. There's nothing extraordinary about that. That's a false dichotomy, extraordinary, unextraordinary.
I would just interject one point for you, Major Thurnwell. I totally agree with you. And the other part of that extraordinary that always strikes me is, let's measure that from common accepted experience that people report. And I think you would then have to, you would really have to support that claim that it's extraordinary. Take the near-death experience, where our best scientific evidence suggests that 10 to 15% of people who suffer a heart attack are experiencing that, and extrapolate that over the world's population, and you have millions and millions and millions of people who have had this experience. The extraordinary claim is to claim that they are not experiencing this. And that's the same with the poltergeist.
Exactly. I mean, I just think it's intellectually dishonest that to call these things extraordinary. They're not. They may be quirky. They may be unpredictable. They may be, happen in 15%. We don't call, if 15% of the nation has diabetes, we don't call those 15% of the people with diabetes that's an extraordinary
right,
group.
Right.
It just happens to be part of the ordinary group. And the last thing I think that's intellectually dishonest is the use of Occam's razor, which you're familiar with.
Of course, right.
The concept. Okay, so their theory is that, the simplest explanation should be the right explanation. And I agree, but it cuts both ways. As you just said, if 1 million people report a ghost phenomena, Occam's razor says that ghosts exist.
Exactly.
It's not the reverse. So I understand that if somebody says a rock falls off the roof, and someone says, well, I think an angel threw the rock off the roof and hit me on the head. Yeah, Occam's razor says, where's the evidence for angels? Did you see anything, or what did you see, and did he so-and-so? Reverse, though, if under good lighting conditions, so-and-so, some of the best is mentioned in best evidence, and again, backed up by all of the footnotes and data and that, if you look at that, you say, Occam's razor says the simplest explanation for this is that there was that there's a poltergeist phenomena, or that there's a ghost, or that there's life after death. The life after death, from a scientific point of view, if you look at the five categories that are there, I think the evidence is overwhelming from Occam's razor that it exists. The question is, we don't know all the details. It doesn't support any specific religion, at least the data I've seen. It doesn't support any specific life after death. Heaven is defined as XYZ. Mike and I often argue about that. But I think that the survival of consciousness, using Occam's razor, if you look at all the data, yeah, we survive. What we don't know is how long, in what condition, under what things, so on and so forth. We have some ideas and some hints from the evidence. But that consciousness survives, I think from Occam's razor, you have to say, yes, it does. So I think those are three examples of intellectual dishonesty that need to be, and then one last intellectual dishonesty is the dishonesty of skeptics and individual scientists. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with a website called skepticalinvestigations.org.
Sure.
And they do a job on Randy. And some of these people that put Randy up as some sort of an honest broker of ideas. And you look at some of those things and you cringe. You say the intellectual dishonesty is stunning. So I think that's another thing I think we've got to except here, there's a tremendous amount of intellectual dishonesty. Anyway, I'm sorry to go on the rant, but that was my...
No, I think it's well deserved, and particularly the point of Occam's razor and parsimony, and certainly we don't want to resort to parsimony as our only explanation. And a lot of people will point out that that's what's really holding back continuation of consciousness moving forward is an underlying theory. But as you point out, at some point, you have to deal with the evidence and say, yes, this may be the best. We don't have a theory for this explanation, but when we look at the data, it is really the only reasonable explanation that we have. And I particularly see that in the near-death experience research, which probably has the tightest scientific backing to support the claim that this is an experience that is really happening. And it's really happening during this period that it shouldn't be happening if the materialistic view of the brain-mind union is really correct. We really have no reason to not accept that consciousness somehow, in some way we don't fully understand, survives our bodily death.
Yeah, again, Mike and I often talk. He lives in Honolulu with me in this area, you know, in this town. And we talk usually once a month. We'll get together for lunch, something like that. I don't think that the near-death experiences alone, the case for the survival of consciousness is concluded. But it's certainly, as Ian Stevenson would say, it's suggestive of. But I think collectively, if you look at out-of-body experiences, the data on that. If you look at the deathbed visions, the data on that by Francis and Harold.
Right.
You look at all these that the mediumship of Eileen Garrett and other great mediums, stuff like that. And you look at that, you've under the most parsimonious view of this thing, based on the evidence, you'd have to say that consciousness has the ability to operate outside the boundaries of space and time, and under near-death experiences, under a state of clinical death. And it suggests that. Is it proven? Absolutely. No. But if I were a betting man, I looked at all the data and the evidence fairly, I'd say I'd bet on that.
I would too. And, you know, I'd bet on the fact that we sure as heck need a lot more research. And there really is no way to explain how there is this gap, between public interest and the science that is supposed to serve that public. And the only way to explain that gap is this paradigm that we've gotten ourselves into, and we've created this taboo that really doesn't make any sense when you kind of pull the sheet back and say, why? Why again are we so afraid to address these fundamental issues that everyone really cares about from the moment they have any kind of intellectual power at all? That's among the first questions they ask. Hey, what happens to me after I die? And where was I before I was born? Where is the I in this thing? I mean, the fact that we can dodge these fundamental questions is, again, to use your word at the beginning, it's stunning.
Well, I think what I understand why science originally did it. If science were honest, it would say, look, we have nothing to say at the moment unless the evidence of parapsychology and scientific anomalies. But in general, we really should focus on the things that we can know through testing, let's say. And at that point, you would give great honor to science, because science has done some great things, and they've really discovered a lot of things.
Right.
That, I mean, I'm a big fan of science in many ways, but I think the problem is when scientists try and stretch back towards religious questions, really who's fighting here is atheistic scientists and fundamentalist religious believers, and the rest of us are left out in the cold. I think, for instance, near-death experiences is a very valid area of scientific research. It's not trying to prove a religious philosophy. It's trying to look at evidence that's come up that may describe how reality works. And if science does that, I think that's a valid thing for science to do. But I think what science shouldn't do is philosophize. I say follow the evidence. Don't play with philosophy. Don't give me your beliefs, whether it's atheism or a belief. Just follow the evidence.
Well, Mike, maybe that's the perfect way to end it then, because that's something we say repeatedly on this show is follow the data, follow the evidence. And you even have the book title for it, The Best Evidence. So that's well done on your part. Thanks so much for joining us today, and I hope that maybe in the future we can call on you again and maybe continue this conversation, because I think there's so many other things we could talk about.
No problem, Alex, and thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks again to Mike for joining me today. If you'd like more information about his book, visit the Skeptico website, where we have a link in the show notes. That's Skeptico, SKEPTIKO.com. There you'll also find links to all our previous shows, as well as an email link to me, a link to our forums, and a couple other things you might find interesting. So check it out. So that's going to about do it for today. Take care, and until next time, bye for now.